Hello, my name's Craig Barton, and welcome to the Tips for Teachers podcast, the show that helps you supercharge your teaching one idea at a time. This episode, I had the absolute pleasure of speaking to Head of Maths and co-host of the excellent Beyond Good podcast, Femi Adenrian. And you are in for an absolute treat. Four quick ones before we dive in. Firstly, sponsor slots for the podcast are open, so if you want to let the world's most interesting listeners know about your book, product or event, just drop me an email. You can view videos of all Femi's tips on the Tips for Teachers website. These are ideal to share in a departmental meeting or a training session. Number three, you can sign up to the all-new Tips for Teachers newsletter. I've been working on this over summer. I'm dead happy with this new format. You'll get a tip in your inbox on Monday mornings to try out that week. You'll get a video to share with a colleague, and you'll also get a podcast to listen to on your way home. And finally, if you find this podcast useful, please could you take a moment of your time to review it on your podcast player of choice. Pause the episode now if you can. Just give us a quick rating. It really does make a difference. Thanks so much. Okay, back to the show. Let's get learning with today's guest, the wonderful Femi Adenrian. Spoiler alert, here are Femi's five tips. Tip one, teach behavior lesson one by making developing the right classroom culture your objective for the early lessons. Tip two, focus on explanations, not resources. Number three, teach in small chunks and fool kids into doing lots of work. Tip four, have your coffee while sitting in the classrooms of effective teachers. And tip five, provide answers so pupils can check their work in real time. If you look on the episode description on your podcast player or visit the episode page on tipsforteachers.co.uk, you'll see I've timestamped each of these tips so you can jump straight to anyone you want to listen to first or re-listen. Enjoy the show. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Femi Adenrian to the Tips for Teachers podcast. Hello, Femi. How are you?
Hello. Nice to speak to you, Craig. Thank you for having me on.
Nice to speak to you too. Right, Femi, for the benefit of listeners, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, ideally in a sentence?
Yeah, so I am head of maths in a large private school. That's after 13 years of being a maths teacher, a second department, and a head of department in the state sector.
Fantastic. Right, let's dive straight in. What's tip number one for us today?
So tip number one is teach behavior lesson one by making developing the right classroom culture your lesson objective in those early lessons.
Ooh, I like it. Tell me about this.
Well, I think this one really comes from me first of all explaining what I believe the goal should be as a teacher of any subject. So, you know, I'm maths, but it could be any subject. I honestly do believe that the goal should be that you're aiming for 100% of the things that you say in a lesson are about your subject and 0% are about behaviour. Now, clearly that's a very high standard to have, and you're never going to achieve that every lesson every day, but I do think it's what you should be aiming for. And it's really interesting because the other day there was a young lady on Twitter who I think very genuinely put a message on saying, I'm an ECT, starting in a few weeks' time, how should I start in September? And loads of people came in with similar things to what I'm saying. So start with being very clear about where you stand, how you want the class to run and running the room and Tom Bennett and all that sort of stuff. And a lot of people just came back just saying, like, no, I don't believe that. Just start teaching. They'll pick it up. The school should have explained the rules to them. They're already teenagers. They should know all this. And I just don't buy into that at all, really. I really don't think that as educators we can criticise young people for not behaving if we haven't explained to them what that behaviour should look like or should be. So I'm all for starting with how we're going to run this class. And also, I listened to your episode with Tom Bennett, and it was really good to hear him. Because I was kind of doing all this stuff, you know, way back really before I was reading any Tom Bennett or listening to podcasts. And it was really interesting to hear him come on and say exactly the same thing. So I mean, what I would say is this is not a rules lesson. This is not a whole hour where you're at the front going through my 45 rules of my class and write them all down and I'm going to test you. It's not nothing like that. It's just being really clear about how you want the class to function.
Right, this is great. Let's dive into this a little bit. So I've done both sides of this. I've tried both. When I first started teaching, I was all about laying down the kind of rules first. And then I thought, sure. Oh, I'm not so sure. Maybe it's do the content first and the rules kind of come a bit later. I'm swinging back the other way around, but I'm really interested in the practicalities of this, Femi. So I want to get you talk us through what would this first lesson look like? Perhaps starting out with these lesson objectives, because that's an area where it often kicks off here. Are you writing those down on the board?
No, these behaviour lesson objectives? No, I don't so much mean that. What I mean is that often teachers would say, oh, yes, lesson one today, I'm starting off with Pythagoras. What are you doing? Or I'm going to do expanding brackets. And they've already got a lesson objective, which is maths related, in their head. And they want the pupils, end of that hour, to understand how to expand single brackets, which, of course, is what we would normally do. What I'm advocating more is my lesson objective, lesson one, lesson two, is that we create the right culture. So, of course, you're teaching maths. But actually, I'm not that interested in how much maths is learned in those few lessons. What I'm interested in is, do I get the culture right so that I can teach maths very quickly and effectively in the lessons that come after the first couple? So I'm not putting them up anywhere. It's just that I'm having that in my mind as how I want this to go. So I would always be, you know, if you come out of lesson one and you say to your colleague in the classroom next door, how did it go? And he or she says, oh, yeah, they can all expand brackets now. Or they're all finding multipliers, really good. That's not really kind of what I was asking. What I'd be asking more is, how did it go in terms of setting the tone for the year?
Got it. All right, well, let's talk about setting the tone then, Femi. What are some of the things you're looking for in that first lesson, and how are you bringing them about? Are you modelling it and then getting the kids to practice? How does this play out practically?
So I think very similar to what you said earlier is that I got it a little bit wrong in my earlier years of going for too much depth in rules. And trying to go through sort of 8-9 things I wanted the kids to know. Now I've boiled it down to just 3 things that I explain very clearly. I do make the kids write it down. We never ever refer back to that those bullet points, but I do make them write it down, I think, to get across to them that this is something that's really important to me. And those rules are just 3 things. One is seating plan. You will sit where I've asked you to sit, and the reason for that is that if I have you in a seating plan, I straight away know who all of you are and I can address you all by name. So it's not about behaviour. I haven't gone to check with your head of year or your tutors who the worst behaved people in year 8 were, nothing like that. It's just I want to be able to eyeball you and say, Tom, how do you feel about question 4? Liam, how do you feel about, you know, and I can do that if I've got you in a seating plan. So that's the first one. The second one is starters. I always say to them that other than this lesson, because of course this is lesson one, when you walk into this room, straight away there will be a starter on the board and you are expected to come in and get on with that immediately. You're not going to open the window. You're not going to go and get a bottle of Coke off your mate. You're not going to go and check something on your phone or anything like that. You are straight in, sat down, and get on. Whether you call it starter, retrieval, do now, whatever it is, it's all just something that we've learned in the past that you're recapping. And the last one is social skills. There is one of me. There are 25, 30 of you. This can only work if you've got something to say, you put your hand up. And then I just basically just kick off. But they've written that down. They've got it in their book. And I think the really key thing from there is that you devilishly follow through with that. So quite often, very early on, you'll see someone just, you know, quite honestly sometimes, or genuinely just, oh, sir, oh, I need a new pen. Sorry, my mum bought... That's calling out, you know? Or in lesson two, you'll see a pupil come in and just wander over to the back of the room because he hasn't been in your classroom before and he just wants to see the rugby pitch because you can see it from your class and he just wants to see if he can see his bike. No, that is not coming in and getting on with the start straight away. So you're setting these up and then you're always going back to them and you're kind of being a bit of a dog with a bone with it. And I think that's really important.
I like it. Okay, just one observation and then just a couple of follow-up questions. I'll tell you where I see this go wrong, Femi, is with your scheme of work, with schemes of work, particularly those that are jam-packed around that first term, and particularly schemes of work that are lesson by lesson, and I have a big problem with them, just full stop anyway. A teacher can look and think, I've got to get through these objectives in this lesson, so I don't have time for this behaviour thing. I'm guessing that, because you said you're not that bothered how much maths gets done, but you can imagine for a less experienced teacher, it's quite hard to make that call, isn't it, and say, I'm going to essentially sacrifice content in the short term because I'm going to get the dividends in the long term. It's quite a big shout for a less experienced teacher.
No, it is. And actually, it's interesting you say that because on our schemes of work at my school, which I've written myself, they specifically in week one say something like classroom routines and setting culture, and that's all it says for the week. Now I wouldn't expect a teacher to be doing that for a week, but I've deliberately put that there so that there isn't straight away pressure of how far are you up with your eights, Craig? What are you on? Oh, I'm on. Oh, I'm behind. I don't want that. So it's not going to happen for a week. I would expect that teachers would be teaching the scheme of work in less than one, or definitely less than two. But I've put it there to take away that pressure. But that's only my school. So I agree with you. And I've worked in schools before. I was a head of department writing the schemes of work myself, where you go in and it is straight away circle theorems, lesson one. And I think, you know, that comes something from leadership, really, is heads of department should be realizing that actually, probably for a young teacher, the number one thing that's making them sweat and worry a little bit over the summer will be the behavior. It won't be teaching expanding brackets. It won't be circle theorems. These people have got degrees. It will be setting the climate of their classroom. So that's the kind of conversation that people should be having with their mentors or their heads of department. And if that isn't happening, then go and have that conversation with your mentor or your head of department. Or actually, I've got another tip later on which will help with that as well.
Fantastic. Just two more quick points on this. How long, roughly, Femi, would it take to go through these three rules in that first lesson?
Yeah, well, again, I mean, I made the mistake in my early years at my first school of it taking half an hour, 45 minutes, and it shouldn't be that. We are talking between the last pupil walking in and the first bit of maths being done, at most 10 to 15 minutes, nothing more. So we're pretty quickly getting on to maths. Yeah.
Got it. And final question, you mentioned kind of revisiting these rules, retrieving these rules, and keeping the standards high in subsequent lessons. Is that a case of just you looking out for the behaviour, and if it's not where you want it, kind of picking the kids up on it? Or are you explicitly providing retrieval opportunities? I'm thinking along the lines of, in your starter, maybe saying things like, what are our three rules in this classroom? Or is it more just a more organic process than that?
Yeah, no, I'd see. I would personally see referring back to those rules with teenagers or kids who are secondary as being a little bit corny. You know, my daughters in year R are going to year one, and I would say it would be perfectly reasonable for the teachers there to be saying, all right, year R, what were our rules for hand washing? Oh, we always do it. That's all right. But I think with teenagers, I wouldn't be putting it in a starter, but I would be constantly going back to it. I can still remember in one school I worked in, teaching a bottom set year 11, and I did all this stuff and I started teaching, and I was about 10 minutes into my first topic of whatever it was I was doing, and a kid, in a well-meaning way, because I got to know him better actually, just shouted out, "Sir, is it true you used to be a doctor?" And that was him, just because he was that kind of quite jumpy, I want to ask, I want to say something kind of kid. And straight away, just bang, I got on him straight away with, you know, what do we say about calling out? What did I say to you 10 minutes ago about how I want to? And you can almost see the mood of the class switch to, okay, this isn't just a teacher who's got rules. This is someone who's actually going to follow up on that. And we just basically didn't have that for the rest of the year. Maybe minor little corrections, but it's really important that you follow through with it.
Fantastic. Right, Femi.
Another thing, actually, I'm actually really hot on as head of department as well. People not interrupting those first lessons. I've been known to send people away because they've come lesson one. Hi, sir, we just want to, can we borrow a set of compasses for the sun? No, sorry, you can't. Now, that would never be happening in lesson 5, 6, 7, but in lesson one, you know, I want to show the pupils there's nothing more important for me than setting up the culture of this class. I've actually sent that person away, and you often see kids like, he said what happened? you know, and I think it's quite a good message to send the kids. There's nothing more important than me and you having this conversation.
I like it. And I mean, who on earth is doing using compasses lesson one? That'd be my question.
Well, there you go. There you go. It does happen.
Right, Femi, what is tip number two, please?
Okay, so tip number two is focus on explanations, not resources. And this is quite an interesting one, and it's in no way criticizing, you know, what you do with your podcast or my podcast that I do, or any books that you can read or Twitter. But I do think there's a big problem in education with teachers spending too long discussing resources and not enough time discussing pure pedagogy. And I think that actually a lot of teachers incorrectly think that a pedagogical discussion is a discussion about websites and whether or not you use MathsWatch or MyMaths or Corbett Maths or Pixie Maths or whatever. And all that's got a purpose, and it all needs to be discussed. And there are definitely some things that are better than others to use in a math lesson. But actually, real pedagogy, in my opinion, is discussing how we're transmitting what we know as mathematicians and math teachers into the minds of the pupils. And that's more about how you're explaining things. Because I actually believe that the resources are just like a sort of a tool of practice for the pupils. And I've been to lessons, I can think of one teacher in my second school who used to use some resources that nobody would touch now. He always used this book called Elvin Revision and Practice, and it was this really dusty old book from the 1970s, and he had to photocopy it and blow up the photocopier so that it was big enough because there were these tiny little exercises. But you'd go into his class and watch him teach, and he was an absolute expert, and you could hear a pin drop, and the kids were on it and working well and loving their maths and focusing and working really hard because he'd got his explanations absolutely watertight. And I actually went to another school quite recently just for the day to have a look at what they were doing. This is a private school, really quite expensive private school. And every lesson I walked into, I wanted to steal their resources because they were really good. And you could say, oh, where'd you get this from? But actually the explanations and the pedagogy of their teaching was quite poor, and the kids actually weren't making much progress. So I really do believe that we need to talk about explanations less than we talk about resources. And actually, in my last school, where I had the department, just for 1 or 2 years, we had a really, really strong team, and we really got this, and we had a lot of what I call sitting on tables, which is when after school you could walk down the corridor and there'd be math teachers just sat on the table talking to each other, and they'd be saying things like, yeah, Craig, I was teaching rationalizing the denominator this morning, and I started with an example that had 3 + √5 on the bottom. I didn't go very well. What would you do? Oh, no, I'd never do that. Let me show you what I use. I always start with this example because it helps them to link it to normal. Oh, right. That's what I think pedagogy is, not exchanging worksheets and talking about apps and things like that.
This is nice. I love this one. Right, okay, so let's dive into this a little bit. So first, just a very quick reflection. I often hear teachers, whether it's in person or on Twitter, you often get the question, have you got anything good on this? So I'm teaching straight lines. Have you got anything good on straight lines? Or have you got anything good on this?
Yes.
And again, you're absolutely right. It's always resource focused. So I completely agree with you that the emphasis is always on resources. The other thing, well, there's a few things I'm interested in here. I think there's a difference between that explanation, but also something else you picked up on, which is the choice of example. And sometimes you can have the best explanation in the world, but if that choice of example's wrong, either kids are going to overgeneralize, or they're going to pick up on something that shouldn't be there. So there's two parts to it, isn't there, Femi? There's getting how you're going to explain it, but before that, what example are you going to choose to start with? And that feels like a big part of this.
Absolutely, and I just don't, even in schools I've worked in recently, I just don't hear enough conversations about this stuff, because it can win or lose a lesson knowing what to pick, what examples to go with, how many examples to do, how to understand when the kids have got that look in their eyes when, yeah, you've got this, okay, we can do some practice now, or no, I think you need one more example on this, so we need one more, guys, yeah, okay, one more. That is where, when I go and watch lessons, I see them being won or lost. It's not on it's rarely on the example of the teacher, the exercises that the teachers are using, because there's so much stuff out there now.
This is really interesting. This so another reflection. I see a lot of departmental meetings when I visit schools. I'm obsessed with departmental meetings. And what you often see in there is that they're admin central, and that's a disaster waiting to happen. It's all about discussions about targets and so on. Whenever you shift the emphasis more to, in inverted commas, pedagogy, what that pedagogy often looks like is what you're describing, where it's not a discussion on explanations. It's, okay, here's a good resource I've used for straight line graphs. Here's a good resource I've used for sequences. So I wonder, what does an effective pedagogy-focused departmental meeting look like for you, Femi?
Oh, Craig, brilliant chat. I love that question. And my honest answer to that is I'm still working on it. And it's still one area in my leadership that I want to get better at. But we have now got to a point in my school where we have what I call no non-admin meetings. So there is absolutely zero admin discussed at all. And it's really interesting, actually, because when I first started doing it, I knew that people probably would be a bit uncomfortable with that. So I used to say I used to put on the agenda at the end, item 3, admin discussion. And people would often at the end in item 3, I'd say, right, okay, guys, really good meeting. Anything for item 3, admin? People would often just feel quite uncomfortable. And they'd say something like, yeah, Can we just discuss the year nine target grades? Are we going to still go with the higher grade that we did? I put that in the email. We're still going to do that. Still going to be the same as the email I sent yesterday. About. Okay, good. And over time, people stopped doing that. And now I still put it on there, but everyone just goes, no, fine, lunch, we're done now, and we move on. So there's lots of things I've tried. I would say the most effective thing that I've done that I really like doing is recording lessons. And actually on the board, and it's so easy to do now with an iPad, just having an example of someone teaching a lesson from our department to our kids, and asking the team to do three things. Firstly is write down one thing that you thought that was effective, one thing that you noticed, and one question you would have for the teacher. And it's quite a vulnerable place to put someone. And I've deliberately started with people that I know won't have a problem with that and are quite confident in their practice, because I think it's, you know, ideally we want everyone to do this, but it really is opening us up to, right, we're really going to discuss what's really happening in the lessons. We're not just going to talk about, oh, my eight's terrible today. They couldn't do straight line graph. Oh, mine were the same. This is a pointless conversation because we can't see what happened. And actually, one person's bad lesson is another person's great lesson.
This is great. I love this. Final question on this, Femi. As a head of department, how concerned are you with consistency of explanation and examples across your team? And I'm just thinking, if you have this discussion, this pedagogical discussion, perhaps you start drawing out, okay, this is a really good way of explaining this. This is a good example. Are you then happy for teachers to then make their own mind up about whether they use that?
It's really interesting you say. So when I started at the school I'm at now, I really wanted to really have a real drive on pedagogy. And I knew that as a department, we weren't yet ready to start talking about, we're all going to teach expanded double brackets in the same way. We're all going to teach Pythagoras in the same way. There was variation across the department. But actually, I think that the general pedagogy of things like recap starters and when the kids are talking, or you're talking, the kids are silent, all that sort of stuff needed addressing before we got to that. We're now at a point where we're starting to think about, actually, as I go around the department, as I do a lot, I do see lots of different methods being used for things, and we do need to start bringing that together, because there's no point in year 10 having pupils who have been taught six different ways of doing something, because the teacher in year 10 is going to have to try to unpick that. So we are now starting to talk about, let's have some uniformity over the way that we're explaining things. But it's by no means PowerPoints. It's by no means email out the PowerPoints and you just go through that and it's all on there. I'm actually quite against that. I don't like that. I'm for teachers to planning their own lessons and deciding how they're going to show things. I was really pleased when I listened to your pod and we had Adam Boxer on. He was talking about modelling. You must model rather than click, click, click. So they can explain it however they like, but I think we do need to have some kind of uniformity over how we're going to do it so that it's consistent as they go up the school.
Got it. All right, Femi, what is tip number three, please?
Okay, so tip number three is teach in small chunks and fool kids into doing lots and lots of work. And this is especially important in the initial stages of the year. So this comes from, I would say, and I've got no data on this, right? But I would say that I think that the number one reason why teachers across the country get frustrated in maths lessons is that they, during the practice part of the lesson when the kids are working, teachers are trying to circulate the room. You see this all the time when you're going to observe lessons. And they're having to do two things at once. They're having to try and correct maths, and they're having to also try and keep kids on task. So they go over to one pupil, and it's like, all right, Tom, no, x times x is x squared. You've put 2x. All right, okay, thanks. All right, boys, turn around, please. I've said to you already. Right, you, what's that bottle doing? Get that bottle. And actually, no one wants to do that. And it's one of the reasons what makes teaching just really tiring. Doing that all day, five lessons a day, six lessons a day, is really tiring. And it probably happens more in tougher, in inverted commas, schools. So the way that I actually first got interested in maths from my uncle was he used to get little scraps of paper and he would set me five questions to do on a bit of paper. This is when I was like 8, 9 years old. And he'd send me off, go and do those. And I'd go back to him and I'd say, right, I've done them all. And he'd go, right, number one's right, number two's right, number three's right, oh, four's wrong, right, three out of five. Okay, have a go again. And I'd go off again. And when I started teaching, I sort of thought, why can't we bring that kind of dopamine hit that you get as a child doing a couple of questions and find out whether they're right or wrong? Can we bring it and use it on the wider scale? So often with more tricky classes or classes that haven't got a really strong work ethic, I use that model. So I will teach them something and I will give them 5 to do plus an extension. Then I will go through those 5 and they'll get instant feedback on how they've got on with lots of cold calling, lots of questioning. Okay, I think you've got that now. Now 5 on something else. And then I'll go through those. And then 5 more on the 2 things combined. And actually, you can fool pupils into doing lots of work and lots of questions in a lesson by doing it like that, rather than the model that you see a lot of teachers try, which is I'll do 2 on the board, and then on your desk is a sheet, and you've got 40 minutes. Come on, stay on task, please. Come on, what are you doing, guys? And actually, I think you need to sometimes fool kids into working hard. So the model that I've described, I wouldn't advocate using for the whole year. If you came into my class in December, I wouldn't be doing that so much anymore. But in those early lessons, you can fool people into doing lots of work. And you know you've cracked it, because they'll say things like, is that in a lesson? I can't. Look how much work I've done. I've done more this year in less than I've done in a whole term. And that's what you want. You want them to do loads and loads of practice. So it's teaching in really, really small chunks. So I'm just going to get a tissue from here. I tried to... Sorry about that. So it's teaching in really, really small chunks and getting the kids to do lots of work in really small periods rather than in really long periods. You see it a lot in sport, actually. I'm quite into rugby, and a really, really skilled rugby coach will get a group of under 9s or under 12s doing little short drills for 5 minutes. Then they'll pull them all in. Right, what did we learn there, guys? Oh, we learned that you've got to space out as a team. Right, good. Now you're going to try this. Bring them in. What did you learn here? Oh, I learned that kicking the ball can be really useful to create space. Good. Bring them back in. That it's a really good sports method that I think you can bring into the classroom.
Oh, this is a really, really good one, this, Femi. So I've a couple of thoughts on this that I'd be interested to get your take on. So I'm very lucky these days. I get to visit loads and loads of schools, and I see some really, really ropey classes. And yeah, the approach from the teacher is exactly what you described, the kind of long periods of sustained work, and it's just a car crash. Yeah. It's an absolute car crash. Yeah. Because as you say, the teacher is just running around the room and so on and so forth. So my advice, I always think, okay, right, well, let's flip this on its head. Let's go for these short, sharp kind of periods of work. Here's some questions. You have a go. Let's feedback and so on. But then a little voice in my head says, well, how are these kids ever going to get to the point where they can do those prolonged periods of focused work? So what does the transition look like for you, Femi? How, if I came to see your class later in the year, how have you got them kind of almost off this model to being able to work for, say, 20 minutes independently?
I think that the number one thing there is you've bred a culture of success. People, humans, not just children, humans like doing things that they are succeeding at. So if you've got a high success rate, and I was really, really excited when I first read Rosenshine a couple of years ago, and it talked about a high success rate, because effective teachers have been talking to me about that for years, and it's like, yes, of course, that makes sense. So if you've got a background of them having a higher success rate on these little mini sections of work, then if you came later on in the year, they would be doing mixed sheets, working for 25 minutes, 35 minutes, because the culture in the room is one of quiet, study, independent on the whole, practice. And they've got used to doing that in your classroom of M1 or M9 or whatever it is. So suddenly when you ask them to do a worksheet for 15 minutes, well, we always work quite hard and quite quietly in Mr. Button's class. So of course I'm not going to start walking around the room or chucking a pen or being rude or shouting out or getting my phone up, because we never do that in here. You've trained them. But I think it's a mistake to think they're going to do that in September. And the other mistake teachers make is often classes will do that lesson 1 or 2 in September, because they've been off for 6 weeks and they're quite pleased to be back, and it's a new teacher they don't know, a new NQT or someone they haven't met before, and it's a new class, they're in a different room, sat with someone they don't really know that well, and they will kind of work quite quietly. And, you know, I always worry a little bit when you hear teachers come out and say, yeah, those 8s I had, I was told they were quite difficult, but yeah, you can hear a pin drop for the whole hour in there. Well, okay, I hope that when I come back in November or in October, it's going to be the same. So you're breeding success, basically, is the answer to your question.
Let me play devil's advocate a little bit here, Femi. I think I'm on board with you on this. But is there a danger that we sacrifice depth in those earlier months? Because I loved Cal Newport's kind of work on deep work and this notion that to really get some valuable stuff done, you need this sustained period of focus. And I can see how you're going to get it maybe, you know, January onwards. But how are you going to get the kids, you know, thinking deeply for in September if they're only ever doing these short chunks?
Well, the short chunks are not necessarily only very brief mini activities. So it's not only, you know, expand to open bracket x plus 3. It can be something deeper, but the key thing to it is it's not for that long a period. So it could be a deeper question. It could be something that involves a little bit more thought. But I would also say that, you know, I by no means get around schools as much as you do. But so often, the number one reason I would say that pupils are not willing to do deep thought, deep work, as you quite rightly call it, if they haven't got the components in place to do it. So I'll go into lessons in some schools that I visit, and you'll say a kid's trying to do a really deep, difficult for them, you know, trigonometry question of a kite attached to a house, and a kid's holding the string of the kite, and the angle of elevation is 45 degrees, and they want to know, and you'll say to a kid, okay, just, okay, you can't do that, so that's fine, let's put that to one side. If I just draw a right angle triangle here, just forget about all the kite and all that, how would you find that, how would you label it? Oh, yeah, I don't know, I can't. Well, this is why we haven't got the deep thought and the deep work. So I think it can and will come if the components are in place.
Got it. Right, Femi, what's tip number four, please?
Tip number four is have your coffee while sat in effective teachers' classrooms. And this goes back to why, you know, we started our own podcast a few months ago. I believe that too often, this isn't all schools, there'll be people listening to this saying, not in my school, and that's great if it's not in your school, but too often in schools, there is a culture of being a good teacher means that you basically get your ticket to being left alone. So being a good teacher means that you're nowhere near competency, you're not necessarily going on to middle leadership or head or SLT, but you're quite good, there's no behaviour issues, there's no parental complaints, and old Jim in M5 gets left alone. And I actually believe that there's some great stuff in terms of CPD from things like this podcast and books you can read. But there's always so much really rich knowledge that comes in your own school. And two things always blow my mind in education. One is that people are willing to get on a train and go all the way to London for a course, but they won't go and watch people in their own school teach. And the second is that people will discuss other members of their department, sometimes very positively, like, oh, he's great, Craig's great. Or sometimes very negatively, oh, Craig, the noise from his classroom. But they haven't actually ever been to see these people teach. They haven't ever been to see the people that they are working with teach. And departments will sit around tables at 4 o'clock discussing things, quite right, like you said earlier, you know, admin and setting and target grades, and they haven't seen each other teach. So I am a real advocate for getting around the school and seeing other teachers teach. And don't get me wrong, I know that in schools, time is really tight and you may only have one free in a day, or you may only have one free across 2 days, and it is really difficult to do, but there's no better CPD in my view than taking your cup of coffee and your marking or your laptop and just sitting in a classroom with another teacher that you think is effective and just soaking up what is going wrong. It doesn't mean sitting there and taking notes. It doesn't mean sitting there and watching everything that's going on, because a lot of it you'll know that, okay, they're just doing their starter and everyone's quiet. I don't need to sit and watch this. I could do a bit of marking. I could do a few emails. But you will learn a lot from just being in that classroom. The best teacher I ever worked with in my early years, a guy called Hugh that we talk about on our podcast, and I used to do that a lot with him. And the things that I would pick up from just being in his room and just seeing him in action, I just don't think you can get any better at CPD than that.
I love this. I absolutely love this. So I completely agree with this. I visit lots of schools, and what's always interesting there is in the mornings, I always ask if I can see as many teachers as possible in as many lessons as possible. And prior to my visit, I've had a chat with the head of department and they've said, right, we're a bit weak in this area. We need a bit of support in this area. And invariably, and it happens every single time, I always see examples of the very kind of practice the head of department wants to bring into play in the team that I'm watching, you know, during the morning session. And it's because the head of department hasn't had an opportunity or a willingness to go and kind of see all his team in action. And as you say, the expertise is almost always found within the school. And it's even better than, you know, going on a train to London, because it's contextual. You know, it's teachers doing it with the kids that you teach and so on and so forth. But here's my two questions for you, Femi. So I'm fully on board with this. But my first question is, how do you get the teachers on board to, you know, allow or want to or be happy with teachers coming in to watch them? Because that, for a lot of teachers, that's quite a biggie, isn't it? You know, because we've especially teachers who've grown up in this observation culture where being observed is, you know, high stakes and so on and so forth. How do you develop the culture where it's absolutely fine for anybody to come into your classroom and sit and watch you teach?
Yeah, it's not easy. And I think one of the benefits that I've got is that when you do your second stint as a head of department, you often know the things that you know maybe didn't get right in your first. So I know that in the school that I work in now, I told the team day one, meeting one, I'm going to be getting around loads of lessons. And of course, it's just because I want to go and see how maths is taught here, and I want to be visible to the pupils, and I want to know what's going on in the department and get to know people and all this. And I think people, because I was new, accepted that more as a kind of new thing that the new guy wants to do, more than they would be if a head department of 4 years announced in September, I'm going to start coming around and watching you teach. Flip, you've never been in once. What do you mean you're going to start coming? You've been 4 years. So it is difficult. And I think that anybody who's starting new as a head department or a head of year, because partially you should do it as well, you know, tutor groups and things, get around and watch your tutor groups and your year group. It's good to do it and announce it early. I think also being really transparent and saying to people, please, you know, that also works backwards as well. Come into my classroom, any lesson, any time, and watch anything that I'm doing. And that's why I think you have to be good at what you're doing to be a head department. You know, if you're a head department, but you're still not too sure about your year nine class because they're a bit difficult and you haven't really got your year sevens where you want to be yet, then you're kind of going to open yourself up to criticism if you try and go into other people's classrooms. So I think you've got to make sure that you spent a good few years honing your craft first. And then I think just positivity. So there will always be things that when you go and see a class that you think are effective. And if you can start to get people having their coffee and saying, yeah, Craig came into my lesson today, just unannounced, just kind of walked in, sat there, oh, did he? What did he say? Oh, he just said how effective it was that I was using my visualizer and how nice he thought it was that the kids were all sort of working on a recap starter so quietly. All right. So the word gets around that this isn't kind of a stick to beat people with. You know, we interviewed Sam Strickland recently, and he does the same thing. I think he said he devotes 2 hours as a head per day to just walking the corridors, which is incredible. And he talks about how this is not deliberate stock taking, this is not quality assurance, this is not a clipboard going around ticking off the good ones and crossing the bad ones. He just gets around and wants to make sure of everything. I think he used a phrase like, is everything to the teacher's liking? So he's actually coming at it from the point of view of, are you all right in here? Rather than, I've come to watch you teach and critique you. I think there is a time when that possibly has to come. So if you're constantly going back into a teacher's classroom and you're seeing something that needs to be corrected, you've got to be willing to have those tough conversations. But initially, just be in there and get used to the fact that you're coming in and that's happening.
Nice. Well, I guess the flip side to that is, what about, how do you convince a teacher who is, you know, doing okay, they're getting good results, everything's going fine, but they're also really busy, they've got, you know, a couple of free periods throughout the week, they've got a load of stuff on. How do you convince them to use that free time to go and see somebody else?
Yeah, no, that is difficult because I think teachers are busy and it is often nice to have some time away from children when you're during the school day, and it may be you've only got 1 hour in that school day. I think the number one way, I would say, is to not give them loads of meaningless things to do that make them really busy. So I would say that in my department, you know, this isn't on my list of five things, but in terms of things like marking, we are only marking one piece of work per week for pupils. We are not bookmarking. I'm completely happy with people using textbooks. I'm completely happy with people using Corbett Maths. sheets because they're just really good. So why are you sat there with a ruler and a pen making your own when they're really good? So let's try and create a culture where we have actually got a little bit of time. We're not kind of frantically running around and doing things that are not that useful. You know, sticking targets on books and, you know, filling in rag sheets on Excel, and it's all been deleted by the previous teacher and you can't work out why, and you spent your whole free period sorting it out. All that sort of stuff shouldn't be going on, really. And also, I think trying to create a culture where people see how excited you are by talking about pedagogy. There is no more beautiful thing, I think, than watching somebody who's really skillful at anything doing their thing, whether it's a builder, whether it's a teacher, whether it's someone who's really good at juggling. And if you can make people realize that actually this is a really difficult job that we do, there aren't that many people who are beyond good. So let's talk about it and let's kind of try and get better as together. I mean, you know, that doesn't answer the question extensively. There are still people who are saying that I am happy just teaching my lessons and then going home. And I get that. But I think if you can build a culture of it, then it does start to grow in the department. And also at interview day, just try and sound people out on this sort of stuff. You know, tell me about the last maths lesson you went to watch. You know, you can start to see who does that and who doesn't.
That's great, that. Again, just one extra point to add to this, Femi. I really like it as well. Whenever you've got teachers who regularly dip into each other's lesson within a department, I think it sends a really strong message to the kids to say, look, we're all in this together. You know, okay, I'm your teacher, but also, you know, the rest of the department, this is a maths department, this is a maths team. And, you know, often behavior improves when another colleague's in the class, but also it's nice to have somebody else in there, another adult in there. You can sometimes bring them into the lesson and so on. It's just a really nice positive feeling whenever staff dip in, and it's not, you know, to observe or to crack down on behavior. It's just there to, you know, be a part of the learning environment. I think it's a lovely thing when that works.
Absolutely. I can still remember, right, okay, taking you back to about 1995 now, under 12s rugby, my first game for the school team, and a teacher called Mr. Child came along to watch the game. Even though he wasn't coaching, he came along. This is Saturdays, right? So he gave off his Saturdays, come along, watch the game. And, you know, I scored a couple of tries, and he pulled me over at the end. He said, you know what? You were really good today. And that meant more to me than any other teacher or parent saying that he'd given up his time to come on a Saturday to watch the game and then said, you were really good. And if that happens in math lessons, so if another teacher comes in to watch another teacher teach, and then says to a group of kids, the girls at the back, you know, you girls were awesome today. Your ability to manipulate surds is so strong for year 9. Well done, girls. That is going to mean so much to them. And that's another reason why I think it's really important.
Love it. Love it. Right, okay, Femi, what is your fifth and final tip, please?
So the last one, and I'm not ashamed to say that I was really excited on the night when I was listening to your podcast and I heard Joe Morgan saying the exact same thing. So I'm afraid we are sharing a tip. But it is answers on real time and explain to kids how to use them. Answers in real time, I should say. So this is moving away from the way that I was taught maths, right? When the teacher would go up the front, they'd do two examples. They'd then say, right, guys, exercise 14B. And then they'd sit down and they'd mark books. And we'd all work our way on the exercise. And at the end, she'd say, oh, 7 minutes to go. Right, okay, let's go through the answers. Question one is 5√3. Yes, I got that right. Question two is 10√3. Oh, yes, yeah. Question three is 5√3 + 4. Oh, no. And then the next six are all wrong. You put cross. And it's just, right, okay, off you go, guys. Have a nice lunch. I mean, that is just ridiculous. And then I went to do my A-levels and at a different school, and we were very much encouraged there to use the textbook and check our answers in real time. So we'd work through an exercise and we would mark it ourselves, and then we'd know whether we were right or wrong. So we knew we were making progress. We knew when we needed to ask the teacher for help, because we got an answer of 16.2, but the book says 38.6. We knew when we were equipped to help somebody else, because Craig's got it right and I've got it wrong, so Craig can have some help. And it was just so obvious and so much more powerful that when I started teaching myself, I just thought, I've got to give the pupils answers as well as the questions, and then they can check their work in real time, and I as a teacher can circulate the room and only deal with problems rather than having to go over and tip tick someone's work. Yeah, that's right, that's right, that's right. And also, you don't get the classic thing of the boy who gets them all wrong and then leaves with his head down. Oh, I'm no good at maths. I knew I wasn't. You know, you get rid of that because then you get to find out how he's doing as we go. So it's a really simple tip, but I use it pretty much all the time. There are some times when you can't use it, right? So things like negative numbers with year seven, they might be doing -2, -5, and the answer's -7. You can't have the answer at the bottom because you've got no idea whether that kid has just written down the answer from the bottom. So there are other ways of doing that. But with things like trigonometry or the quadratic formula or solving equations, a complicated equation where the answer is x is 6, and you've got to have lots of lines of working, get them marking their own work. It's just so obvious. And it blows my mind the number of teachers who still revert back to this kind of like answers at the end, kind of, or I'll take your books in the market. So answers in real time.
I love it. Right, okay. So three questions on this, Femi, for you. So the first one is the obvious objection to this, which is some kids are just going to use that as an excuse to not do work and just kind of copy stuff down. How do you counteract that?
Well, my answer to that would be similar to what I said to you earlier, really, which is people like having success. So why is it that people go to escape rooms and we'll spend hours in escape rooms, and they could easily get their phones out and Google the answers to all the escape rooms, but they don't, because they want to work it out for themselves. Children are no different to that. They on the whole, and I'm talking like some quite tough inner city schools that I've worked in where I've done this, won't do that if they feel they are equipped with the understanding to do it themselves. You often see that happening when kids just don't get it. And so they just think, oh, flipping it, well, I don't know, 18, 24, there you go, I've done it, yeah, tick, 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 got them all right, sir. They won't do that if they've been taught well, it's been explained to them clearly, they've had a couple of check questions to do before they went onto the sheet, where they got the chance to find out if they were right without the answers, and they got those right, and they're happy with the method. They then will work without cheating, in my experience. I'm talking about, you know, low ability or low prior attaining kids in tough areas will do this if the environment is created for them. The other thing I'll say about it, actually, is it really helps what I call the seven silent students. And that is, roughly, I say, in every class of 30, there are about seven students, I've got no research for this, is just kind of my estimation, who, unless they're directly spoken to and challenged, spoken to, will say nothing at all. They're not mute, they're not kind of, nothing wrong with them, they're quite vocal at home with their mates, but in a lesson they just don't like to say too much. And it really helps them as well, because they often get left behind, because the bigger personalities will dominate with behaviour or with being really bright or better than the others in the class, and the teacher goes to them first. And these guys just want to get on, but they often get things wrong and just very quietly have found ways of kind of masking that without ever having to speak to the teacher. Whereas if they've got the answers as well, they can go through it and know whether they're getting it right or wrong. So I think it really helps them.
Got it. Okay, so follow-up question number two. I think this works quite easily in terms of sixth form or A-level classes, because perhaps they're working from textbooks and so on, and they, you know, they can flick to the back or whatever it is. If you've got a year 7, 8, or 9 class and you're maybe doing it from a worksheet or something, or questions on the board, how practically do you give access to the answers?
So normally if I'm working on a worksheet, they are on the back. So it's not really easy just to flick your eyes down to the bottom and you can see, well, the answer's 5. So there you go. They would be on the back. And I would be very much circulating the room. And as well as I am checking the maths and making sure that people are adding 2 to both sides and dividing by blah, 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 I'm also checking that people are using the exercise in the right way. So I will go and stand behind kids as they work and just watch them. Yeah, okay, I can see. And you can see the difference between a kid who is solving equations and checking if they're right and a kid who is making sure they've checked the answer first and then using that and working backwards. So just by circulating and by creating that culture of course we wouldn't do that, you know. Again, it comes down to classroom culture. But I would say, okay. You know, I get what you're saying about year 7 and year 8. But normally, I find, in my experience anyway, the work we're doing in secondary school has at least got some steps to it. So not that much of what I do in year 7 upwards is just one step. So I don't know, find 10% of 42. Well, the answer is 4.2. There's no working out that's really needed there. A kid could just write down 42. Quite quickly, even with low ability kids, I'm getting on to something that requires some kind of work. So it might be find 15% of 42. Right, we've got to write down 10% is 4.2. 5% is 2.1. 50. I want to see all that written down before you're turning the sheet over and checking your answer. And I would have gone through all that on the board before I let loose on the sheet.
Well, my final question on this, Femi, kind of comes back to that, because I think that there's quite a few areas of mathematics, particularly the fundamentals, where if you have the answer, you kind of have everything. So we'll go back to your negative numbers one before. So your negative number operations, you know, it's if the answer's there, it's hard to, you know, what working do you want the kid to put for, you know, -5, -2 or whatever. Sure. Even something like expanding a single bracket, if you see the answer there, it's, you know, it's kind of done and dusted. Rounding, there's a whole host of maths where if you have the answer, it's kind of everything. So what do you do with that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so things like that, I think you still can use the same approach. And I found it really interesting, actually, on your pod when Jo Morgan said, very honestly, she said, there may be a few pupils in my class who are sneakily using the answers to some extent to gain an advantage. But I'm still gaining a lot more than I'm losing if they weren't there. And the second thing I'd say to that is also, at least once a week in my department and other departments I've worked in, we are taking all of that away, and they do a mini assessment under test conditions on all the work we've done recently. So over time, not that we ever would explicitly say this, but they do realise that what we're doing in the practice phase of lessons, we're practicing, we're training, if you like. So there's no point going back to the rugby analogy, I keep talking about rugby, of in our training session, we throw the ball forwards because it's easier and we can score lots of tries doing that. But then on Saturday when we play, the referee actually stops us doing that. And then so we can't do it anymore. So we're going to struggle on Saturday, aren't we? Because we can't do that. So they do realise that this is just kind of practice for my weekly assessment, for my end of term tests, for my GCSE. And I honestly don't think, if you came to one of my lessons and spoke to even some of the year 7s and 8s and lower ability and said to them, just out of interest, do you use the answers to cheat or do you use them to actually check if you're right? I think they would say to you, no, Mr. Barton, I use them because I want to know if it's right or not. So I do 5 and I check them, and then I either work out that I've gone wrong, or I put my hand up and he comes round and then he checks. Because it's actually quite interesting that something that I have had from non-maths observers that come in is them not recognising that this can be done until they see it done. So I think it definitely can be done if they realise that it's practice. You're gaining nothing from doing this.
That's brilliant. That is brilliant. Right, I love those, Femi. They are 5 absolutely great tips, and I love them because there's some brand new stuff that we've not considered there, but also stuff that builds upon things that other guests have said. So that's fantastic. So let me hand over to you. What should listeners be checking out of yours?
So myself and a friend, Matt Finley, a good friend of mine who worked within my second school, we have another maths podcast which we call Beyond Good. And it's called Beyond Good because it's something that I talked about earlier, in that I think we should always be striving to go beyond that kind of very standard, he's an all right math teacher that you see in a lot of schools, or he's serviceable, you know, no parental complaints, gets all right exam results if the kids are quite well behaved, all that sort of stuff. So it's really a discussion about what can we be doing in our classroom to go beyond good. And it's not me and Matt thinking that we are the experts in this, that we know it all. We've got as many questions as we have answers, you know. That's one thing I love about your podcast, and that you speak to people, lots of different people who are very well known, Adam Boxer, you know, people who are not well known like me, but you've got as many questions as you have answers. And I think that's how we should be. So we speak to other teachers, we speak to head teachers, we've got a recent couple of episodes with pupils, which we love, because we just ask pupils, how do you feel when you're put in sets? How do you feel when a teacher says, right, pick someone to work with? It's just fascinating, people voice. So we do that, and we just love talking about it. So that's Beyond Good, which you can find in most podcast places. Also, I would recommend a book called The Behaviour Manual by Sam Strickland, which is actually a manual, right? So it's got like 105 chapters or something, little bits that you can just dip into if you want to learn about behaviour or setting or settling a class down or assemblies or whatever it is. He's really good on just giving little nuggets. So it's like you're getting 5 minutes of his time every time that you read a chapter. That's really good. And another book called Naylor's Natter, which is a book, a guy called Phil Naylor, who used to do a podcast and has now put together a book, which is all the brilliant conversations that he's had with people on his podcast. And the really cool thing about his book is that if you read something, you think that's really interesting, you can then just scan your phone on the page, the QR code, and it takes you into the podcast, and then you can listen to it. So I think that's really cool. So that's really good. And the last one, a really big plug for school visits. Go and see other schools. Ask your head of department, can I go and visit that big private school down the road because I want to see what they're doing? Can I go and visit that pupil referral unit because I want to see what they do with really, really challenging kids? That, in my view, is the best form of CPD.
Fantastic. Brilliant stuff. And yeah, as you know, Femi, I'm a huge fan of your podcast. I think you've got a really good dynamic going there, and you cover things that not a lot of other podcasts do. So I'm a big fan of that. I'm a regular listener there, and I'm really pleased you've been able to come on this show and share some of your insights. So Femi, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
Thanks, Craig. Thanks for having me.